the great fundamental issue now before our people can be taken free. It is, are the American people fit to govern themselves, to rule themselves, to control themselves? I believe they are. My opponents do not.
I favor the American system of individual enterprise. I am in favor of protection. I believe in the permanent cost and further limitation of armaments. I am opposed to aggressive war.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
Whether we shape the future in the image of our hopes is ours is to determine by our actions and our choices. If we succeed, generations to come will say of us now living that we mastered our moment.
Americanism, not globalism, will be our credo.
Bringing Heartland America into the heart of the swamp. This is The Right Take.
Hello, everybody. How's it going? Welcome, one and all, to episode number 60 of The Right Take, our own little diamond jubilee here, 60 episodes in, a little over 1 year since we launched. I am Eric Lendrum, here with my co-host Jacob Grandstaff, and first and foremost, of course, we all hope you had a very happy Easter Sunday yesterday. Hopefully, most of you were able to take a little break from filling out your taxes and whatnot to celebrate this, of course, very special and the holiest of holidays. I know I was certainly able to enjoy my Sunday. Jacob, did you enjoy your Easter Sunday?
Yeah, I was finally able to make it out to that sunrise service they do on the National Mall, the Lincoln Memorial. They canceled it the past 2 years in a row because of COVID. Mm-hmm. I was here in 2018, 2019, meant to go both times, but I can't remember exactly the reason, but you know, each time maybe I just slept in. I wasn't able to make it both those years, so it was good to finally be able to go to that Easter service. Great weather, and that's something that mm-hmm. we haven't had lately in D.C. We had a little bit of warm weather in mid-March, and then we got another dose of winter for like 3 weeks straight, just nothing but rain, sleet, hailed a little bit a couple of days, got down to 25 degrees at one point. So it's nice to finally see some nice spring weather for Easter. I mean, it was a good 55 degrees, nice, crisp and cool, but yeah, it was beautiful, clear.
It's a roller coaster when it comes to the weather out here. Again, not too long ago, it was snowing on a Sunday, and then by like Tuesday, it was back to like being in the high 70s and low 80s. It's mm-hmm. just very strange weather around here. But yeah, we're looking at some nice weather in the high 70s towards the end of this week as well. So it loves to mess with us around here. DC, Arlington weather loves to mess with you and make you think you're finally out of the winter and you're moving into the nice warmer weather of spring and summer, and then just slaps you with another week of winter weather. So, but once again, hope you all had a very, very happy Easter. We got to roll right into this one. Just like last episode, we got to start off. There's some really good news to start off this episode. We're going to be talking about a lot of, again, some very big issues, the issues that are dominating the political right in terms of the conversation right now. We are going to talk about the unlikely possible savior, speaking of saviors, the possible savior of free speech here in America and his war against big tech. We are going to talk about the latest absolute insanity from the left that is leading to their own infighting. But to start off, once again, a great big fat white pill for you guys. Oh, when I saw this, I was just giggling. I was so giddy. So Thursday, NBC News first had the story, the reports that President Trump was getting ready to endorse J.D. Vance in the Ohio Senate race. Now, this, of course, it has been described. We talked about it before several times here on the podcast. It has been described as the most competitive Republican primary in the entire country for any office. You had five major candidates. For a while, you had six, and now you have five competing for, obviously, a very contentious nomination in a state that was once seen as a quintessential swing state along with Florida and Iowa, but has trended solidly Republican in recent years. Again, Trump won it by 8 points, both in 2016 and 2020, which was the largest margin of victory for any presidential candidate since Bush Sr. in 1988. So it's less of a swing state and more now of a solidly Republican state. And this is the race to succeed Rob Portman, a Republican who is retiring. And this is a race where you need all hands on deck because the apparent Democratic nominee will be Congressman Tim Ryan, the guy who ran for president for 5 minutes back in 2020, who originally was kind of Bernie style, you know, working class blue collar Democrat who wasn't so crazy he wasn't totally against Trump. He was, you know, pretty solid on trade and immigration. Then he ran for president. He went all in on race baiting and, you know, the woke nonsense. But he's the front runner. He's the only major candidate. And he's raised a lot of money. He's got millions backing him already. So we need the best candidate we can get. And President Trump, he made his official endorsement on Friday. And I went ahead and I have the statement here, April 15th, 2022. MAGA patriots from across the nation are set to deliver an election landslide for Republicans that will serve as a devastating rebuke of the failures of Joe Biden and the radical left Democrats. In the great state of Ohio, the candidate most qualified and ready to win in November is J.D. Vance. We cannot play games. It is all about winning! Exclamation mark. This is where it gets important. Second paragraph. Quote, like some others, J.D. Vance may have said some not so great things about me in the past, but he gets it now, and I have seen that in spades. He is our best chance for victory in what could be a very tough race. He goes on to mention that this is not an easy endorsement for me to make because I like and respect some of the other candidates in the race. They've said great things about Trump. He puts Trump in quotation marks. And like me, they love Ohio and love our country. I've studied this race closely, and I think J.D. is the most likely to take out the weak but dangerous Democrat opponent. Dangerous because they will have so much money to spend. And we'll post a link to this full statement in the description below. It's a good statement, and it summarizes that, you know, this is not a shoe-in endorsement. This is not endorsing an already established front runner. This is not endorsing someone who's been with Trump from day one. This was a very contentious primary for quite some time. And as we mentioned before, the front runner in the polls for the longest time was State Treasurer Josh Mandel, who recently has kind of duking it out for first place with businessman Mike Gibbons, with Vance kind of in a further back in third place. But the key here is that Ohio, like Arizona, for example, and some other primaries, in every single poll you look at, the top option, the most popular option, either the largest plurality or even sometimes outright majorities, 50-51%, was never for a single candidate. It was for the undecided option. So it's very much a race where most primary voters still had not made up their minds. And in Ohio, more so than in a state like Alabama, we talked about the Mo Brooks debacle a while ago and how Alabama is a state where Republican voters very well do love Trump, but they don't care nearly as much what he says in his endorsement. Ohio is not like that. Ohio is very much a state that gravitated towards Trump's style of working class politics, you know, supporting blue collar workers and white working class. And they are more likely to listen to him specifically as an individual, and especially considering he endorsed a guy who also is running very much on this working class populism. I had to talk a little bit about the inter-party fireworks that were going on. This is from the original NBC report. When the reports first broke that Trump was getting ready to endorse J.D. Vance, this is just too funny. Quote, in recent days, Trump has begun calling donors and advisors, to get their opinions on endorsing the Hillbilly Elegy author. But he held off under intense pressure from the rival Republican campaigns of Josh Mandel and Jane Timken. That's the former chair of the Ohio GOP. Quote, the Mandel people hit the roof, one Republican with knowledge of discussions told NBC News, noting that Representative Jim Jordan tried to dissuade Trump from making an endorsement, since Jordan apparently remained neutral in the race, but he did not want Trump to endorse Vance. But in the days leading up to Trump's endorsement, basically, when the reports were coming out, a handful of other people jumped in to further endorse Vance, including Congressman Matt Gaetz and even the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., who also came out in support of him. Now, Vance had already been endorsed by several crucial people, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, Tucker Carlson, Peter Thiel, who donated $10 million to Vance's primary campaign. So and Charlie Kirk as well, Turning Point USA, and their 501c4 Turning Point Action. So a lot of people high up in Trump world that he either has high opinions of or people who are actually close to his inner circle all supported Vance. So it kind of makes sense that he would ultimately go for Vance at this point. But again, this one more thing that happened too that I thought was definitely worth noting. This is from Politico, is that when the reports came out that Trump was getting ready to endorse Vance, the Ohio GOP establishment immediately kicked it into overdrive to try to stop Trump from endorsing Vance. Politico says that, quote, Republican rivals to J.D. Vance have embarked on a last-ditch effort to stave off an endorsement from Donald Trump in Ohio's Senate primary. There was a letter that was circulated by multiple county Republican parties in Ohio, all like co-signatures and whatnot, saying, quote, J.D. Vance will still lose even with President Trump's endorsement. J.D. Vance is widely known by Republican primary voters for his never-Trumper comments and his calling Trump supporters racists. Since he is already known to Ohioans as a self-proclaimed never-Trumper, and voters will be forcefully reminded of that, Vance will still lose even with President Trump's endorsement. So the article notes that, of course, this letter that was circulated, this open letter to Trump to not endorse Vance, the only thing they had against Vance for like why Trump should endorse him is because, oh, he criticized you in 2016. And yes, this is documented. He posted tweets about it saying he called Trump racist. He said Trump was disgusting. He said he would ultimately vote for Evan McMuffin in the 2016 election, the independent guy from Utah. But that's the only thing they have. They don't go after him for skeletons in his closet. They don't go after him for his stance on immigration or anything like that, or business dealings with China. They go after him for being anti-Trump. And this is the one thing you will always see. Like, Jacob, you mentioned that you could see every time Breitbart ever did an article on J.D. Vance, the comments would overwhelmingly be saying pretty much the same exact thing, right?
Well, it's not just Breitbart. It's pretty much any outlet on the right that does that covers Vance at all. There's always an army of online trolls that go on and bash Vance. And they always try to take the angle that, well, he was anti-Trump, so he's a rhino or anything like that. Well, I saw one comment that said, J.D. Vance is a Yale graduate trying to pretend like he's a hillbilly. But I'm like, wait a minute. Don't you want hillbillies to improve themselves and go to Yale and become right. elites and basically come back and fight or go to Washington and fight for the values and the people that they left behind whenever they left out to go, you know, make something themselves?
Exactly. But that's just the American dream.
It almost makes it seem like, I mean, I don't want to accuse anybody of doing something they're not, but it's almost like there's an army of paid trolls going to every single article on J.D. Vance and trying to trash his name. So
exactly.
It's really disappointing to see.
It feels very AstroTurf, and if they're not outright bots. And I think that I had heard, I can't quite confirm this, but I'd heard from inside sources that was a tactic primarily being started by Josh Mandel's campaign. Or either Josh Mandel or Tim Ryan. It was one of those two. Tim Ryan, the Democrat. It was one of those two. If it's Ryan, then it was really smart on his part to put that information out there and really get that ball rolling, because obviously he wanted to try to weaken the guy that he saw as the biggest threat. So, but yeah, they were putting that out there as basically kind of opposition research to get Republicans to drive a forceful wedge between Vance and the people he most needed in this primary, which was Trump supporters. But of course, it needs to be said, if Trump himself is willing to forgive that and endorse him anyway, then why shouldn't everybody else? Like, at that point, they have no leg to stand on. That if Vance is ultimately endorsed by the guy that he criticized, that would show that all that is water under the bridge, and Trump clearly thinks he's the best candidate. So at this point, I think those are mostly, like you said, they're either paid trolls, or specifically they are with a campaign, they're with a Mandel campaign or the Tim King campaign or whatever, and they're just coping, and they cannot stand the fact that Trump endorsed this guy.
Well, J.D. Vance's entry into that Senate race should have cleared the field of any pro-Trump candidate. Mm-hmm. Like, they should have just stood down. It's like, okay, this is the altar of hillbilly elegy. We're just going to stand down. We're going to run for a House race, or we'll do something else. But yeah, there's really no reason why there should be another Trumpian candidate in. I mean, J.D. Vance really was the face, really the international face of the left behind Midwest that voted for Trump, switched a lot of these, because Trump really broke the Democratic Party in Ohio.
Yep.
Ohio was a swing state before Trump came along, and now it's solidly red. It's more red than Texas. It goes like 10 points, 12 points red. Texas now is going 4, 5, 6 points red. So the idea that any of these other candidates would try to out-Trump J.D. Vance is just ridiculous. Now, in his book, Hillbilly Elegy came out in 2016, right before the election. And I remember in the book, he claims that he believed that Trump was going to lose, but then the right should try to take these voters that Trump brought along and try to do something with them. So, you know, at the time, he was anti-Trump. He expected Trump to lose, didn't think he would win. But if you made the point yesterday, I believe, that if Trump never endorsed anyone who opposed him before he won the election, then he wouldn't be endorsing too many people.
Exactly. There were a lot of people who from the very beginning were not in favor of Trump, who now have, of course, become strong Trump allies, or at the very least are not complete. Not everyone who was once against Trump is a Mitt Romney or a Susan Collins. Like, they are able. I believe in the ability of redemption and people to convert to the truth, basically.
Convert to the truth. So I actually wasn't a hardcore Trump supporter until the Charlottesville riot in 2017, when I saw how Trump wasn't going to be cowed by the media. Before that, I was a very, very reluctant Trump supporter. In fact, the very first article I ever published in my life was a Trump hit piece. I was writing for Odyssey Online, which is a college publication, and my first article was bashing Trump because I was so anti-Trump during the primaries. I mean, I went from Rand Paul then to Ted Cruz. I was chomping. Like, I followed the primaries intensively, hoping that Trump would lose, that Marco Rubio would drop out, that the right would coalesce around Ted Cruz, and that they would all gang up and defeat Trump. When Trump was the ultimate nominee, then I was like, okay, I'm tuning out. I didn't follow the election at all during the general election because I was like, you know, it doesn't matter. If Trump loses, big deal. We'll just get him again in 2020. But whenever I saw that Trump wasn't going to back down to the mob in 2017, in August 2017, in the Charlottesville thing, I was like, okay, yeah, Trump all the way. But a lot of people are like that. Like, a lot of people, they never came around to Trump until 2018, 2019.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Dennis Prager is another great example. You know, he originally was for Ted Cruz and was very much against Trump until Trump became the nominee. And he said, all right, we've got to support him, whether you like him or not. He's the nominee. And now Prager, of course, is a very prominent pro-Trump advocate. I had to delve back a bit into the dynamics of this race just a little bit more because this is so funny. We talked in a previous episode about, or we played a clip in a previous episode of a primary debate where the two frontrunners, again, Mandel and Gibbons, got up in each other's faces and almost got into a physical fight on the stage in front of everybody. And we're thinking, wow, this race really is just spiraling out of control. It's insane. But there's even more to note in this this article. So this comes from, again, this is from the earliest reporting from NBC and also Politico, noting that Trump apparently was ultimately determined to make an endorsement. Some people were suggesting he would sit out altogether, but he was determined to make an endorsement when one of the top five candidates, State Senator Matt Dolin, ultimately came out as the one candidate who was not really trying to court Trump's support and not trying to court the Trump base. He was very explicitly running as an anti-Trumper, as a matter of fact. He said of the other four candidates who were all very much vying for Trump's endorsement, he accused them of, quote, having embraced lies and undermined the Constitution to go all in for one endorsement. They cheapened their candidacies and the integrity of the office they wish to attain with campaigns that are now in chaos as ballots are being cast, end quote. That's in reference to early voting. So Trump heard that and it was like, okay, screw this guy. I have to endorse one of those other four because I don't want the off chance that this guy gets elected. So he then turned to the remaining four, which again is Mandel, Timken, Gibbons, and Vance. From this reporting, Gibbons, quote, was never on Trump's radar. He had reservations about Mandel, primarily due to, again, we mentioned that debate incident where he basically almost got into a fight with Mike Gibbons. And Trump saw that clip and referred to his conduct as, quote, embarrassing. And then Jane Timken was another interesting one. She, again, she was chair of the Ohio GOP. Apparently, Trump supported her bid for that seat in 2017. But then Timken's campaign was running a few questionable ads in this Senate race referencing Trump's support for her chair bid and very vaguely misrepresenting that to make it seem that Trump had endorsed her for Senate. And Trump's people got a hold of that and definitely did not like that she was basically falsifying an endorsement in the Senate race. Furthermore, she was making arrangements to ultimately go to Mar-a-Lago to meet President Trump. But then when the reports first came out that he was considering endorsing Vance, she canceled the planned meeting. And I'm like, okay, really? At that point, girl, you just ruined yourself. I mean, when you hear news that he is simply considering endorsing your opponent, that makes you just rage quit and not meet him at all. Like, that's being a sore loser. And at that point, she absolutely deserved what she got. She deserved to be snubbed at that point. So it was quite funny to see, I think, at this point that, like we predicted, a lot of these other candidates kind of went at each other's throats so much and didn't really think about Vance that they cleared a path for Vance to ultimately become the nominee through. And he probably will win this nomination with a plurality. I don't think he'll get a majority of votes. He will see a bump in the polls for sure. Because the Trafalgar Group, widely considered the most reliable pollster in the country, they had a poll right before Trump's endorsement came out where it was two questions. The first, of course, is who do you support? Mandel came in first with 28%, Vance in second with 23%, and everyone else way farther behind. The second question of the poll asked, what are your opinions on if Trump endorses a candidate? 55% of respondents said they are more likely to vote for whichever candidate Trump endorses. And that was right before Trump endorsed Vance. So I think, again, winning a plurality, Vance could win this nomination pretty handily. And also, again, the fact that the entire Ohio GOP establishment came out in droves to try to block his endorsement, that kind of sounds a little familiar, doesn't it, Jacob? That sounds kind of like what they tried to do to Trump in 2016. So I think Trump very much sees a lot of himself in Vance. And again, acknowledging he said bad things in the past, he is willing to accept and forgive and let bygones be bygones. And it's interesting to note, by the way, J.D. Vance, he it's probably because of the beard. He looks a lot older than he actually is. He's only 38 years old. He'll be 38 by the time of the election. So he has plenty of time ahead of himself in his life for a long career in Ohio, which, of course, has been a kingmaker state in politics for quite some time. Of course, seven presidents come from the state of Ohio, second highest of any state, only behind Virginia with eight. And certainly after whatever happens in 24, whether it's Trump running again or DeSantis or whatever, Vance has quite a few opportunities in the future to build up his political career. And I think after a good amount of time, maybe we could see Mr. Hillbilly Man run for president one day. What do you think of that, Jacob?
It's way too early to even be.
Way too, I don't know.
You're looking at 2032, 2036.
I'm a J.D. Vance stan.
We'll get to there when we get there.
I'm a J.D. Vance stan, and I always will be. So, I mean, I fully support the idea of this man one day becoming president.
Well, I don't support anyone running for president until I've first seen them perform in a lower – well, unless they're a businessman. That's the only exception. If they're a successful businessman, I say go for it. But in the case of J.D. Vance, I would want to see how he votes in the Senate, make sure he's going to stick to his guns.
All right. Fair enough. And again, this is, as we've mentioned before, this is also very important, a crucial turning point, I think, in Trump's endorsement game. Because as we noted, prior to 2022 – only three of Trump's primary endorsements out of like 150 or 180 had ever lost an election. Three out of between 150 and 180. That's a pretty good record. But of course, in 2022 alone, we've seen quite a few mishaps. You know, his original candidate in the Pennsylvania Senate primary, Sean Parnell, ultimately withdrew from the race due to losing custody of his kids. Trump was forced to rescind his endorsement of Mo Brooks in Alabama. And his choices for governor in both Idaho and Georgia, that's Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeachin and former Senator David Perdue, both seem to be trailing the incumbent governors, Brad Little and Brian Kemp, respectively, and in polling for the primaries. So it looks – a lot of people are bringing into question whether or not Trump is kind of losing his touch when it comes to, you know, in how powerful his endorsement is. So if this one ultimately does turn around this race for Vance, that will be a huge win for Trump. People were questioning some of these endorsements as bad endorsements. There was a lot of controversy about, for example, in the Pennsylvania Senate race, he ultimately endorsed Dr. Oz instead of David McCormick, and there was a lot of hubbub on social media about that. Previously, Trump's endorsement in Tennessee's 5th congressional district for Morgan Ortegas instead of Robbie Starbuck also led to a lot of controversy. So this was definitely an endorsement that to bring a lot of those black-pilled people back into realizing that Trump still very much makes mostly good decisions. He makes some bad endorsements for sure. Again, being from California, he made a very bad endorsement in the 2018 governor's race back there in my old home state. But I fully support his decision behind this. And there's one more thing I had to talk about with regards to this Vance thing, and then we'll move on. I already wanted to talk about this even before the news of the endorsement broke. I saw this on Twitter the other day, and I just had to talk about it. This is one more reason why you should support a guy like Vance. The media hates him and loses their minds over him. On Twitter, some loser by the name of Greg Sargent, who's a writer at the Washington Post, of all things, did a lengthy thread just whining and moaning about J.D. Vance's comments about Ukraine, where basically Vance's stance is, yeah, what's happening in Ukraine is terrible, but we have more pressing problems right here at home. Namely, we have our own border that is being invaded by way more people than the Ukrainian border is right now. Fact check, true. So Sargent tweets, quote, "As vile as it gets, J.D. Vance has now gone full great replacement theory. He also just doubled down on the odious talking point that we should care more about our border than that of Ukraine."
Good grief.
Odious? Hold on. So it's odious as in repulsive, disgusting, sick. It's disgusting and sick to want to protect our border more than another country's border? I mean, Jacob, is this America or is this the EU he's talking about here?
Well, we're going to be doing a special episode on immigration here in a couple of weeks, possibly even next week. But one of the things that we're going to point out is that these elites, they don't see the United States as a real country. They see it as an economic zone. And, you know, for you to support the borders of this economic zone and the people who were born in this economic zone over future residents of this economic zone is just reprehensible. I mean, you're basically two steps from Hitler at that point.
Exactly. There's more tweets here. And again, I'll post a link to this tweet thread in the description below. But he just goes on and on posting screen. He wrote an article about this at Washington Post with that title, "As Vile as It Gets." And he's posting screenshots from his own article and quoting it at the same time. Like, wow, vanity much? Like, you've got to quote yourself twice. A little further down, he says, "J.D. Vance wants you to know that only one invasion should overwhelmingly preoccupy you right now. And it's not the one where war crimes are mounting and dead civilians are littering the streets." Again, yes. I mean, yeah, call me heartless. I'm sorry. I care more about our border than that of Ukraine. Yeah, what's happening in Ukraine is terrible. So is what's happening in the Congo right now. You know, there's
as a global citizen, that makes you a traitor.
Apparently, yeah,
you're a traitor because
I'm a traitor.
We're all supposed to be global citizens now.
He goes on. It gets richer and richer. We have to keep roasting this guy. Here's a weird thing. A hallmark of conservative populism is that it's supposed to appeal to working class voters of all races. So why do people like J.D. Vance assume all migrants, presuming they become citizens, and their descendants will vote Democratic? Question mark. Because they do, you moron. That's the point. That's literally why. Why else do you think Biden and Kamala and every single Democrat candidate for president said they would give free healthcare to illegals? Why do you think they are so hellbent on amnesty and open borders? They want them to come here. And yes, they do become citizens through amnesty, through DACA programs and whatnot. They want them to come here and be amnestied so they will vote loyally for Democrats for at least three generations. That is a fact. A lot of them have said it. Julian Castro giggled about it in a TV interview saying, Texas is about to turn blue. Like, he could not contain his excitement. But this idiot is still going to run around parading like, oh, that's a conspiracy theory. They don't come here and become citizens. They don't come here and vote. That's ludicrous.
And the idea that their kids aren't going to vote that way, this is specifically out of their playbook. Like, Terry McAuliffe told a group of Salvadorans, y'all need to hurry up and start making babies faster, because if you can get to 11%, then we'll have the state in our grip. So this is, I mean, this is what he literally said. So
yep.
It's, you know, this is what they believe.
You know, Biden famously, you know, said in 2016, back when he was still vice president, he said that, you know, by a certain year, I forget which year, we played a video of it on the show, by a certain year, white Americans will be a minority. And that's not a bad thing. Like, they're open about this fact. And Nancy Pelosi said the future face of America is brown skin. They are open about this. The final tweet in this thread, I just had to close on this. J.D. Vance says we should care more about our own border than that of Ukraine, and says we, in quotation marks, face an invasion, in quotation marks, that amounts to an emergency. That's not just a silly talking point. It's a real argument about what the international order should look like. Yes. I mean, well, first off, it's wrong in that we don't think there should be any international order. That shouldn't be a thing. Again, the fact they're using this phrase now, international order, Biden just the other day literally said new world order. They're being open about it. But the fact of the matter is that, yes, if there is any semblance of an international order, it should be sovereign nations looking out for themselves and protecting their own borders without invading other nations, without violating other nations' sovereignty. You know, again, like Hungary or these Eastern European countries, you know, Hungary is not invading their neighbors. They are securing their own rights for their own citizens. They are keeping migrants out. They are looking out for their own civilization and culture. That is beautiful. That is good. That is okay. That is what we want to happen. That is what the future of the West should be. And indeed, that's the only future the West has. If that is not the approach that the West takes, there will not be a West anymore. But of course, you know that, don't you, you dirty globalist shill? You know that that's exactly the death of the West, if we do not adopt a policy like that fast enough. And that's why these people, these Washington Compost morons, they hate J.D. Vance. They hate what he stands for. And that is why Trump made the right choice in Ohio.
Well, speaking of endorsements, so we've talked a lot about how the Democratic Party tends to tribalize. Like, they believe that you can create a big umbrella, a big tent, and have all these little groups, these ethnic groups, these religious groups, these sexual groups that will all vote for the Democrat if you can just unite this big tent and basically build your party on the idea of a big tent rather than have an assimilation, rather than have a melting pot, have a salad bowl. And this is their vision for America. The problem, though, is whenever you empower ethnic minorities, they want representation the same way that nations at the UN want representation. So in the UN, each nation elects representatives, and those representatives go represent their country in the UN. When you bring in immigrant groups and you treat them like as if the same way we treat our black minority, then you start to create a sense of entitlement that they should be represented in the U.S. government the same way that, say, a nation is represented in the UN, or the same way that a state is represented in the U.S. Congress. I remember a conversation a few years ago, this was during the Senate primary in California, there was a conversation, it was like an online group chat, and some Californians of Mexican descent were arguing that the next Democratic senator needs to be Mexican. He needs to be of Mexican extraction because they haven't had a Mexican senator from California, and they represent a plurality of California residents. And a lot of the liberals from New England, they were in the group chat, they were arguing, why would you argue that? That doesn't make any sense. Wouldn't you just want the best person who's qualified for the job? And they were adamant, no, we need representation. Representation matters because we are a plurality, and we don't have anyone representing us. So in their mindset, a liberal Democrat who is of non-Mexican ancestry could not represent them. because he doesn't represent them ethnically. And this is the mentality that the Democratic Party is creating among these groups, because these groups now, it's not enough to – it's like in Boston. Remember the Boston mayoral race? How you had a lady who – an Asian American woman, you had a Black American woman, a bunch of different group identities that were running in the mayoral race. The Asian American woman won the race, and she's now mayor of Boston. And the Black Democrats in Boston, they were writing op-eds criticizing her for speaking for Black rights. And they were basically arguing she should have stood aside and let a Black woman become mayor. Well, in Oregon, this is from Politico, says a slap in the face. House Dems super PAC sparks Latino backlash. Andrea Salinas has endorsements from top Latino groups and from half of the Latino Democratic lawmakers in the House. She also has backing from the Congressional Hispanic Caucus's campaign arm in her bid to become Oregon's first elected Latina in Congress. Yet House Majority PAC, which is closely aligned with Speaker Nancy Pelosi, delivered an unexpected blow last week to Salinas' campaign. In a newly drawn district that's more than 20% Latino, the House Democrats' flagship super PAC chose to intervene in the primary and plow $1 million into television ads on behalf of a white first-time candidate. That decision has sparked an outpouring of criticism and left Democratic strategists and Latino leaders fuming over what they say is an unnecessary mess. It's evidence, they say, of the party's failure to invest in the resources necessary to excite and court Latinos or to take seriously the recent erosion of support among those voters. The fallout over the House Minority PAC's endorsement of Carrick Flynn comes at an inopportune time for Democrats. At a time when Republicans are making gains with Latino voters, the blow-up serves as a reminder of the ongoing challenges and internal Democratic Party debate over the efficacy of its outreach to Latino voters. And then they go on talking about how it doesn't make any sense that they would endorse Flynn. The only explanation they could really come up with it is that the House Majority PAC decided to throw its support behind Flynn because there's another billionaire who is big into – he's a billionaire who started a crypto exchange, and he supports Flynn. He's been throwing a lot of money into Flynn, so it seems like Flynn might win. So it seems like the House Majority PAC is just backing who they think is the apparent winner. But the Latino caucus, the Hispanic caucus, and all these Latinos in the Democratic Party, they're outraged. It's like, why would you endorse him? So, for instance, Selena said, this is a highly competitive primary, and we have four women in the race, three of whom are women of color. Now, Eric, why don't you Google Andrea Salinas, Oregon, real quick, and tell me how colored she looks.
All right. We're doing this live right now here on The Right Take. Andrea Salinas.
Now, she's Mexican. Keep in mind, her father immigrated in the 50s from Mexico. So, Andrea Salinas, Oregon.
Oh, goodness. I'm looking at her picture right now. Wow. Yeah. She looks about as white as you could expect.
So I'm looking at a picture of five of the candidates, which is a ton of candidates in this race. They show five of them at the Marion County Democrats in Oregon. And at first I was trying to pick her out. I was like, where is she at? Because I see four white people and one woman who looks Black. I zoom in. She's definitely Black. I thought, okay, maybe she's a Latina of African extraction. Because there are – in southern Mexico, there are some Mexicans of African ancestry who assimilated into the population. But then I looked underneath and it said five Democratic candidates for a House seat for Oregon's new 6th congressional district appear before the press in Salem, Oregon. From left, first one seated to the left, Andrea Salinas. I'm like, wow, she's the whitest one in the group. So there, she's complaining the Hispanic, which why do we have a Hispanic caucus in the House? I get having a Black congressional caucus because they are a legitimate native minority to this country. We shouldn't have a Hispanic congressional caucus. They're an immigrant group like Italians. We don't have an Italian congressional caucus. We don't have a German congressional caucus. Why do we have a Hispanic congressional caucus? But they're complaining that the Democratic Party is backing the apparent winner whenever they've got three or four women and three of them are women of color. So it shows their mentality. They genuinely believe that just because the Democratic Party has been playing into this anti-white rhetoric that the Democratic Party is really going to give preference to people, the so-called quote-unquote people of color and women, rather than back the apparent winner. And it just shows that you're going to have a rift. And what's even more perplexing is that these Latino Democrats, they actually think that they're going to boost support among Latino Americans by playing into racial politics and identity politics. A lot of the reason why Hispanics are backing Republicans is because they're just assimilating. That's really all it is. They haven't really changed their opinions much on policy. It's just they're assimilating. They're feeling more like Americans. They look at the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is doing everything it can to keep immigrants from assimilating and becoming Americans. The Republican Party is like, hey, we support Americans regardless of of what your ancestry is. So like, okay, well, I'm going to vote Republican.
Exactly.
It's more emotionally based. It's more identity based. And ironically, the Democrats are actually shooting themselves in the foot, because as generations grow up in America, they grow up speaking English. Like, even if around this area, a lot of the second generation, the kids, they all speak English to one another. They don't even speak Spanish. They can't, like, the parents will speak to them in Spanish and they'll respond in English because they can't speak Spanish. They can understand it, but they can't speak it.
That really is another white pill when it comes to demographics and their push for multiculturalism and diversity backfiring on them. Because, you know, it's different to me with when it comes to black voters, for example. You look at how both black voters and Hispanic voters are souring on Biden heavily. The approval ratings for Biden among both those demographics have plummeted completely. I think the Quinnipiac poll, the latest Quinnipiac poll that had Biden at 33% overall again, had his support among Hispanics at 26%. Now, I think a key difference here is that with black voters, they largely are starting to drop their support for him because they feel he's not doing enough. He started his presidency really well with, you know, reparations for black farmers. He gave them a brand new holiday. And of course, he just did get a black woman confirmed to the Supreme Court. But after that, he failed to get that big voting rights bill, you know, passed, which have we even heard about that in a long time, Jacob? That's kind of not being talked about anymore, isn't it?
It's just talked about as much as Build Back Better.
Exactly. So that is kind of what's going on there. Whereas with Hispanics, they are actually leaving Biden, not because, oh, Biden's not doing enough for them because he's not giving amnesty. It's because he is hurting the country and he is actively hurting them. And these voters are the ones who are more likely to not only not support Democrats anymore, they are more likely to go to Republicans. We saw this again in 2020. Trump made huge gains with Hispanic voters in key districts in Texas and Florida, especially the ones located along the southern border. So this is another really big white pill. We posted a little bit about this on our Gab and other social medias in accounts in the last few weeks. But this is further good news that, again, this little house of cards that they've built for themselves is just that. It cannot hold. Without a common element of hatred of white people or hatred of a particular person like Trump, it falls apart very, very quickly on itself because they can't help but start bickering with each other. It's the same reason why Stop Asian Hate ultimately became a failure, because it ended up inadvertently pitting Asians against black people, because the most infamous examples of Asians being suddenly murdered in the streets, the perpetrators were all black people. So it is something, a system that may work in the short term. It worked after the race riots and it worked in 2020 with the help of voter fraud, but it ultimately cannot last long term. And they are realizing that the hard way now. And that is good for America.
So the question then remains is, how did somebody like Andrea Salinas, who grew up in this country, she was born in this country. I mean, again, her father immigrated. His parents moved here when he was a child back in the 50s. And so he was a worker. She grew up kind of poorish, but she was still born in this country, raised in this country. So the question remains, how did she come to embrace identity politics? Because if you look at her, obviously, I'm sure as a child growing up in Oregon, she did not consider herself any different from the white children she went to school with. I mean, Oregon is like 95% white, and back then it was like 99% white. So yeah, she assimilated. She grew up as an American, as a white American girl, and now all of a sudden, as a politician, she considers herself a woman of color. So where did this come from? Why would she suddenly, as a politician, find it opportune to differentiate herself because of her last name and her ancestry from her fellow white Americans? Well, she went to Berkeley. That's the answer. It's like Kamala Harris. Like, her father completely rejects the whole anti-white identitarianism, leftism that she espouses. And he's Jamaican. And he completely rejects that. Well, Kamala Harris, like a lot of people whom the left has designated separate, or as they like to say, has otherized. It's funny, they accuse the right of otherizing minorities, but they otherize these minorities specifically for political gain. They want to try to otherize these people to make them separate from the white majority because they see this as the way to build their coalition, because they can't run on the issues. There's no issue that the Democratic Party supports other than healthcare that actually appeals to voters now. So the only thing they have left is to try to otherize all these groups and build a multi-ethnic coalition to go against the dominant majority. But in her case, it's this college radicalized her. That's why she now thinks of herself as different from just an American, because of the university she went to in Berkeley.
And I do think it's funny, again, you had me do this little experiment just now live during the taping of this episode to look up a picture of her and see if she looks Hispanic. I have to point this out because this is a problem also on the right. There is one that reminds me perfectly of one example in my old home state of California. Jacob, I want you to do me a favor now. Go on your computer and type in Jessica Patterson, California, or California Republican Party, and go ahead and tell me if you think what racial makeup you think this woman is.
She's white.
That is the thing, though. She very much looks white, But when she ran for California GOP chair, the position she holds right now, she proudly campaigned as, "I am a millennial Latina mom." And again, yeah, you look at, not only does she look white, but again, her last name is Patterson. So it, maybe this is like an Elizabeth Warren situation. She's like 116th Mexican or something. I'm not sure. But this is the thing. This is pandering that is on both sides. But again, in terms of, for the sake of relevance to forwarding the political discourse in this country and making our situation better, it's better for us that this is happening on the left, because the left just eats themselves alive over this. Whereas when the right does it, it's cringe every now and then, but the right doesn't go into conniptions over, you know, a woman who is white claiming to be Hispanic, or who looks white but supposedly is Hispanic.
Well, if the right does, if you see the Republican Party doing this, it shows that they're in a situation like California where they're completely outgunned and they're just basically throwing anything at the wall and hoping that it sticks. Oh, well, look, we've got a Latina, or, you know, she's married to, this is kind of like Selena. She's married to a white American. And I mean, she looks white herself. It's like, oh, she's a Latina. But yeah, this really is kind of detrimental to the country, because if you try to divide people based on their ancestry, and this is growing up, like, you had people that were geeking out over their Irish ancestry and calling themselves Irish, or their Italian ancestry and calling themselves Italian.
Yeah,
and
same thing.
When you meet Irish people, they don't really appreciate that, because it's like, wait a minute, I'm Irish. Like, why are you trying to pretend like you're something that you're not? Like, you're American. You speak with an American accent. You don't talk like I do. You know, you don't eat the food. You don't even eat Irish food at this point. So this is a problem. Like, this is really in our education system. America has been indoctrinated. It has been indoctrinating its citizens that we're not a real nation. We're not a real people. We're just basically a salad bowl of a bunch of different peoples all thrown together, and we're nothing, basically. And whenever you can convince a people that they're nothing, that they have no history, that they have no identity of their own, then they're not going to support policies that increase their well-being, because it's almost like they feel like they're bastards, that they don't have a real father. Like, they don't really, we're just a bunch of mixture of just basically a bunch of mongrels, a bunch of mixed breeds, which every ethnicity is like that. If you take any ethnicity in Europe and you go back far enough, their ancestors were a bunch of mixed breed mongrels. They were part Slav, part Celt, part Roman, part this, part that, and they eventually formed and developed into a cohesive tribe. That's basically what happened in America. You had British and Germans and Irish all came together and formed a cohesive tribe that was Anglophone in our language, but we are a separate ethnicity. And this is what the right needs to push back hardest on, is because this will eventually divide the country. This is how you split a country into multiple factions and create civil war in the future.
So for the main topic, ladies and gentlemen, what else could we talk about but the madman himself? No, not President Trump. The other madman, Elon freaking Musk. You know we had to talk about this. It's what everyone's talking about right now, and it is truly hilarious. If you haven't been following this, where have you been? Elon Musk has made the left go absolutely nuts, especially on social media. It's the most delicious when they have their meltdowns on social media, and when their meltdowns are happening because of social media. So again, the rundown is Elon Musk came out of nowhere, and like an absolute madman, he bought 9.2% of Twitter stocks with his wealth, which amounted, the price he paid for that was a little over 1% of his overall net worth. Because again, he is the richest man in the world as the owner of Tesla and SpaceX. And he, with that single purchase, instantly became the largest shareholder of Twitter. And of course, this is one of those companies where those with the really large shares can have direct creative decisions over the future of the company. So just like that, it turned into a bit of a war for ownership of Twitter. And Musk, they offered him a position on their board of directors, which of course at the time seemed like, oh, maybe this is, you know, they're already caving and Musk is going to have a position of power. Not true, as it turns out. It was a ploy by Twitter to try to stop him, because there is a rule with the board of directors that if you sit on the board, you cannot own more than 15% total shares of Twitter. So that would kneecap him at 15%. So he rejected that offer to serve on the board. And then he countered with an offer to buy Twitter outright for $43 billion, again, a fragment of his total wealth, in cash, by the way, $43 billion in cash, which would ultimately result in each share increasing its value to $54 a share, which would make all the other shareholders very, very happy. It would very much increase their value. So,
and by the way, just because it's easy to remember, this would have overvalued Twitter 54% over what it was the day before Musk decided to buy in.
So that now Twitter is in a really tough spot. And you have a handful of other developments, like some hedge fund or a company called Vanguard immediately bought even more shares of Twitter to have a slightly larger share than Musk did. So he's not number one anymore. Twitter enacted a poison pill policy to, again, really financial lingo here, to basically increase the value of shares in the event that someone buys more than 50% of shares to try to stave off another massive purchase by Musk. But all these little efforts, obviously try to stop him, still ultimately did not do anything to stop his buyout offer. And this is where he's got them in a standoff here, you know, like a duel at high noon in a Western movie. He's got them in a standoff here because now they either accept his offer and he buys the company completely and takes it private, by the way. That's what he wants to do. Or they reject his offer. The only problem for them is that if they reject this offer to increase Twitter's value, as you said, Jacob, then the entire board of directors, including the CEO, this Indian guy, Parag Agrawal, they are all guilty. They're all liable of violating their fiduciary duties to the shareholders, which their goal is to increase the value of stocks for their shareholders. It's to put more money in the shareholders' pockets. They will be in direct violation of that, having turned down a very lucrative deal. Again, this will generate a profit for Twitter. But they are prepared, and you know they would, if they could without that penalty, they would turn down this deal. They would bite the financial bullet to continue their ideological war on free speech, because that's what they want to do. So they are stuck between a rock and a hard place right now, and Elon's not backing down. He said at a TED Talk recently on the subject that he even has a plan B in mind in the event that they do not accept his offer, because he said this offer is his, quote, last, his best and final offer. So he is not backing down on this. And the overarching opinion seems to be, as he's expressed on his own Twitter account and elsewhere on Joe Rogan's podcast and whatnot, he is very concerned about Twitter's handling of free speech or lack thereof, that they're just censoring everybody. They banned the president of the United States. He understands that they are not really adhering to the true principle of freedom of speech. And he obviously has suggested that when he takes over, he's going to roll back a lot of those moderation rules, bring back a lot of banned accounts. And of course, this has led to a lot of people speculating that in the event that he purchases Twitter, they would reinstate President Trump's account and Trump would be back on Twitter, which was always his biggest megaphone out of all of them, even more than the mainstream media. His Twitter account, which had 90 million followers by the time it was banned, that would immediately propel him right back to even more relevance and would be a huge weapon for him going back into the 2024 presidential election. Tucker Carlson said on his show the other day that this fight, this battle between Musk and Twitter could be the most significant development for freedom of speech in modern American history. And there's a lot we can discuss about this, Jacob, because I know you and I had some slight disagreements going into this, because you were a little skeptical of the fact that, you know, or at least you mentioned it's a sad state of affairs that in America we are depending on a foreign-born CEO to be the guy to potentially bail us out of mass censorship in one of the biggest, you know, public squares, the biggest platforms in the world, which is currently run by another foreign-born CEO. But I have my confidence in Elon. I have my faith in Elon. I've had this feeling about him for a while that, if nothing else, I think, yeah, he's definitely weird. He's eccentric. He is rich. So you could argue technically he's out of touch because he is stupidly wealthy. You know, he talks about going to Mars and whatnot. But I genuinely do not believe, from his mannerisms, from the things he said, and certainly from his latest actions, but even before this, I've never believed for a second that Elon Musk hates the American people and that he hates America like a lot of these other CEOs, like Bezos, like Parag Agrawal, like Mark Zuckerberg. I don't think he hates America like these people do. I think he genuinely does value freedom of speech and American ideals. Because again, as an immigrant, you know, he is an immigrant to this country, born in South Africa. And I think that might be at the crux of all. He comes from a country that is one of the few most perfect examples of exactly what it is the left wants in their multicultural diversity utopia. They want a society where white people are systematically oppressed, and that is exactly what is happening in South Africa. And he does not want that coming here to America. So, and he sees that, you know, this suppression on Twitter is a key part of that. So I think at underlying motivations for why he's doing this, I think, are good. And I trust him, and I really hope he can pull this off. This is going to be a heck of a battle, because this is not a political battle. This is not a matter of just winning a ballot in November. This is, it's, you could argue it's a war of attrition. It's a matter of who has more resources. It's a matter of if someone else pools even more money to try to outbid him, basically, which again is basically impossible because he is the wealthiest man in the world. The second richest is Jeff Bezos, and I'm sure he's got better things to do right now, sending more celebrities to outer space. But there's, at that point, worst case scenario for Musk, it turns into a bidding war to try to increase the amount of money he's willing to spend on Twitter, which could make a bit of a dent in his resources. But again, he's got more to offer than anybody else in the world. So I'm Team Elon all the way, and I'm really curious to see how this unfolds.
Well, I don't think that I think he intends to take this battle with Twitter all the way. My contention about us relying on a foreign CEO is this is an example of the American people abdicating their responsibility to take control of their own institutions and the businesses, really to use the government to crack down on the excess of capitalism. And you see, at this point, people are looking to people like Elon Musk to save them. They're looking to people like Donald Trump to save them. They're looking at billionaires to come in, swoop in, and take over these institutions and use these institutions for the people when they have the power to take control of these institutions themselves. We have the power through the vote, through the ballot. We could regulate Twitter. We could regulate Facebook. We could regulate YouTube. Heck, we could take these companies over. The government could seize these assets and run them through a bureaucracy, which a lot of people, obviously on the right, we hate bureaucrats, we hate bureaucracies. But if you consider the fact that bureaucracies are hired by department heads who are appointed by politicians, who are confirmed by politicians, who are elected by us, who do we have more control over? Do we have more control over bureaucracies, or do we have more control over the boards of, say, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Google, etc.? So I would love to see – the thing is, like, I want to see Elon Musk take over Twitter, but if Elon Musk takes over Twitter, that won't solve the problem. At this point,
it won't solve the problem, but it will be a big victory nonetheless.
It'll be a huge victory, but at this point, the problem I see is a lot of on the right will become complacent about seeing that Section 230 is amended, seeing that we take control of these companies through the vote, through the ballot box. And if the thing is, like, Musk himself has wondered whether or not he would actually even have the capital to pay $43 million for Twitter. And if he did, it would drain him nearly dry to the point to where, okay, so that takes care of Twitter. What about Facebook? What about YouTube? Yeah. What about Google? What about Instagram? You know, we got all these other companies, and we don't have enough billionaires who are sympathetic to our calls to pull their resources together and take over these companies and use them for the people. But the situation, you know, this is another thing. Why is Elon Musk? So let's suppose that the American people are too lethargic to use the government to regulate these companies. And just as, you know, without going into too much detail, it would be very simple. You know, forget Section 230. You could simply pass a law, even if you don't want to nationalize these countries, you could pass a law to make judicial review apply to someone being removed from a social media platform. You could pass a law to make it so to where people have to go to a third party, or the companies have to go to a third party to kick people off, or people can appeal to a third party to say, look, I did not violate their terms of service, because most of the people who have been kicked off of Twitter have not violated Twitter's terms of service, and Twitter purposely makes their terms of service so vague to where they can use that to apply to anything or anybody. I had just recently had a burner account kicked off of Twitter. I had one follower, and I got kicked out for no explanation. And I'm sure the only reason is because I was commenting under articles favorable toward Russia. So they're like, okay, well, you're gone. No explanation given. But if you have clearly defined terms of service, because this goes back to classical liberalism and contractual agreements and contract enforcement. If you have clearly defined terms of service and a person does not explicitly violate those terms of service and they're eliminated from the platform, they're kicked off the platform, they should be able to go to a third party and appeal and have that, you know, overturned, have received compensation or what have you, especially if they had a business that they were relying on the social media outlet. But with Elon taking over Twitter, that will solve the Twitter question. But then you still need to build up the political. Oh, I was going to go back to the billionaires. So it's encouraging that Elon is doing this, which, again, it's sad that we have to rely on a foreign billionaire to do this. But where are the American-born billionaires? Where are all the donors to the Republican Party? They should be pulling their resources and joining Elon Musk and saying, hey, look, let's all buy 4% of Twitter, 5% of Twitter. We'll pull our resources and we'll eventually have a hostile takeover of this company.
Yeah, that's because that's something we've talked about before is, you know, the handful of major billionaires on the American right. Again, you know, Sheldon Adelson unfortunately died a few years ago. He was, you know, the wealthiest and he donated the most to Trump's campaign in 2016. Possibly if he had been involved with a few others, we could have done something. Again, him and like maybe Paul Singer, the Wilkes brothers, the guys who basically bankrolled the Daily Wire and prior to that, you know, made Ted Cruz's presidential campaign. Obviously, you can forget about the Kochs. One of the Kochs died recently, but the other Koch, the surviving Koch, is not on our side. Peter Thiel is one who comes to mind, but again, he's only worth, I think, about $8 billion. I mean, only $8 billion, but obviously compared to Elon Musk or some of these other guys, that's peanuts. So, I mean, he could maybe try to make a little dent as a shareholder, but he could only go so far. So, again, Musk being literally the wealthiest man in the world, the wealthiest man in modern history, is to its advantage. But I did want to push back a little bit because, of course, we've talked a lot about that. We've all on the right, this discourse has been going on for quite some time, Section 230 and other laws we can pass. My only issue with that is, of course, A, even getting these laws passed, assuming you can get them through a Republican majority in Congress without, you know, a Romney or a Collins screwing it up like they always do with Obamacare and stuff like that, McCain's and whatnot. But even if you do get those laws passed, you inevitably are going to see challenges in court. You're going to see some judge in Hawaii block this 230 rule. And there's going to be, of course, lengthy debates in the halls of various courts throughout the country, primarily because the First Amendment obviously could not account for something like social media. It could not account for private companies censoring people on platforms that are very crucial to our political discourse as a nation. So those questions would be keep going on and on and on. And I would argue, I mean, again, I do support using the government to the best of our ability when we are in power. But this Elon Musk situation presents a possibility of how about, if nothing else, this we got to this situation in the first place because of unfettered capitalism, of crony capitalism, of big, you know, big companies, big corporations like big tech being able to run free with no restrictions and get to these monopolies they have now, these monopolies over key zones of the internet where speech is super important, whether it's YouTube sharing for videos, search engine for Google, social media posting for Facebook, microblogging for Twitter, picture sharing for Instagram. You know, they got to this point because of unfettered capitalism. So now, ironically enough, the monster that capitalism created could very well be defeated by another creature of capitalism, that being someone like Elon Musk, which again, you know, Musk could buy out Twitter. No judge is going to block his purchase of Twitter. You know, there's nothing they can do to try to hold him up in court the way they did with Trump for every year of his presidency. So that would be my only counter. Again, I do support the government option when possible, but for the time being, and to completely rob the left of what ammo they had, again, that they used on Trump, I, again, support what Elon Musk is doing and see it as potentially possibly more effective and certainly even faster than using the government option.
Well, speaking of crony capitalism, you have to keep in mind that Google has contracts with the federal government.
Yes.
Twitter, I don't know what their contract, if they have contracts with the federal government, but the people who run Twitter, and even if they don't, even if these major corporations don't have explicit contracts with the federal mm-hmm. government, you got to remember their CEOs, their board members, the people who run the censorship at these companies, they all graduated from the exact same colleges that the people who run the CIA, the FBI, the DIA, all these federal bureaucracies, the military, the DOD, these people who graduated, like Mark Milley, I think he graduated from Princeton.
They're all in cahoots. Yeah, there's no question.
They all graduated from the same colleges. They all have the same goal, the ultimate civilizational goal, which is to liberalize the world, make the entire world safe for democracy. Okay, so get this. Shortly after Elon Musk put his offer on the table, the Security Exchange Commission and the Justice Department launched a joint investigation into Musk's business activities, and they haven't disclosed what exactly they're investigating. They've just announced a joint investigation. The SEC and the DOJ are now investigating Elon Musk and his companies. So the thing is, the right doesn't want to use government to go after woke corporations. The right doesn't want to use government to nationalize corporations or prosecute leftist CEOs. The left doesn't have a problem with this. They control the DOJ. They control the SEC. And one thing we have to take into consideration, I'm sure Elon Musk has this in the back of his mind. If the deep state wants to, they can have Elon Musk in prison and bankrupt in a year. Just because he's worth $43 million, he doesn't have the right – he doesn't have an army at his disposal. He doesn't have an army of bureaucrats at his disposal. They can fine-tune. They can go through every single paper of every single tax law and every single tax filing that his companies have ever filed, and they can dig something up. I'm sure with every company in America, you can find something where they violated tax law. They can slap a fine on him. They can seize his assets. So this is something we have to understand when it comes to government. Yes, it's good that we can find billionaires that are on our side and want to help us out. But ultimately, who controls the power in this country? It's the deep state. It's the intelligence agencies. It's all these people, these bureaucrats around Washington, D.C. And we saw with Donald Trump, they're willing to break the law to take him down. They were willing, these bureaucrats were willing to leak info, illegally leak info to news outlets in order to damage Trump. It's the same way with Elon Musk. So this is something, it's good that Elon Musk is doing this. And it's going to be interesting how this plays out if he's going to be successful. But even if he is successful, he's going to have to fight tooth and nail, not just against Twitter's board, but against his own government, because the government is going to thwart him every step of the way because they understand the power of Twitter. If you go back to the Arab Spring, Twitter was leading the charge during the Arab Spring.
Along with Facebook, yeah.
Yes, along with Facebook. And the reason was because they believed, just like the U.S. government, just like the Obama administration, that this was a good thing for the world, because these totalitarian, Islamic-leaning, conservative governments were going to get overthrown by a bunch of young, liberal, tech-savvy millennials. These young tech, Western-oriented, tech-savvy millennials were going to restore these countries. They were going to build Western-leaning, liberal, secular democracies, and the Middle East was going to become peaceful. So if you believe that, if you genuinely believe that, then you're going to do everything in your power, even breaking the rules on your social media accounts to support their efforts. And that's what they did. They allowed their social media companies. They allowed violent videos to be spread as propaganda. They allowed these youngsters to use Twitter to further their calls. And a lot of times they ended up creating worse situations like Libya than existed before the case. So if they're willing to do this, and like Twitter and Facebook, they changed their rules during the Russian invasion to say, okay, it's now okay to say that it's okay to kill Russians. We've changed our violence policy because we're going to support Ukraine. So with companies that are so in bed with the intelligence agencies, Musk is going to have to fight the intelligence agencies. He's going to have to fight the SEC, the DOJ, if he wants to actually go through with this, because the DOJ is not going to sit idly by and allow him to take over Twitter and restore it to 2016.
Yeah, that is a really scary thought. I was not even aware of that. But again, if there's one man in the world at this point who has the resources, and not just the resources, he's not just some obscure ultra-wealthy individual, you know, like for a brief period of time when the world's wealthiest man was some Mexican businessman that nobody had heard of. This is a guy who has crafted and cultivated a personality around himself, this public persona. He goes on Joe Rogan's podcast and smokes a joint. You know, he's very well known for being kind of odd, but lovable in a goofy sort of way for his public appearances and whatnot. People do genuinely like him as a person. They like his memes on Twitter. They like what he is doing. You know, when he's talking about going to Mars and setting up human colonies on the moon. So he is someone that people genuinely liked even before this Twitter war. And certainly now a lot of people support what he is doing with Twitter. So he's definitely got popular support on his side. Again, that probably doesn't mean much up against the DOJ investigation, but that is better than coming from out of nowhere and having no popular support going into a battle as important as this one.
What's funny is all the leftist commentators, they're arguing, because for years they've been arguing that, because we started off with, you know, screw the billionaires, let's seize their wealth, let's tax the rich and all that. And eventually, as Occupy Wall Street kind of fizzled out and it became obvious that Obama was not going to crack down on the rich because of his donors, then the left, the establishment press kind of changed their tune. It's like, okay, well, it's okay for billionaires to exist, but they need to exercise social responsibility. And so when Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post, they were like, okay, so this is an example of a billionaire using his power wisely to protect democracy. He's going to salvage this dying newspaper and rehabilitate it into an anti-Trump engine. And it's funny how they're starting to change their tune. They're like, well, and they basically are saying it's okay when our billionaires exercise social responsibility, but it's not okay when billionaires who don't follow the party line exercise social responsibility. And they're actually recognizing that what Elon Musk is doing is following their billionaires' steps.
Playbook. He's using their rules against them.
Because like they asked him, he was on a TED Talk shortly after he announced his intention to buy Twitter, and they asked him, you know, what his intentions were, and he explained, because of free speech, he doesn't believe that you can advance civilization, which he's correct. You can't enhance human civilization if people are denied entry to the public square.
Mm-hmm.
And Twitter, more than any other social media app, has been like the public square, especially regarding politics. And he said, I don't care about the economics. And so a lot of these leftist bloggers and leftist opinion makers, they were saying, okay, well, he is following in our footsteps by not caring about his own profit margins, because he may lose money on this, and caring more about his social influence and the social responsibility. But he's going about it the wrong way. And like this, they're saying, this is what can happen if billionaires take this too seriously and don't follow our playbook. But you mentioned how Twitter is wanting to introduce this poison pill and want to dilute their shares.
Yep.
They recently agreed to that. This actually happened during the original robber baron era. Vanderbilt wanted to take over the Erie Railroad back in after the Civil War, and it had three owners. And he started buying up the stocks, and so they started diluting the stocks. And he just kept buying more. They kept diluting. He kept buying more. He was, you know, just burning his money through this railroad. And eventually, a judge ruled against the three owners and told them that they couldn't continue to dilute their stocks like this. They couldn't introduce this poison pill. So these three men, they all fled to New Jersey and boarded themselves up in a hotel with a bunch of hired thugs to fight off the hired thugs of the government who would come and try to invade them. And eventually they reached a deal where they agreed to kick out Daniel Drew, and the other two took over the company. and Vanderbilt was able to the company ended up having to buy their stocks back. So this tactic isn't new. It was really introduced in the 1980s to keep billionaires from being able to stage hostile takeovers of companies. And during the, you know, like during Trump's heyday, a lot of billionaires wanted to just take over everything, play Monopoly with America, with Wall Street. I think at this point, Musk, he said he's got a plan B. I'm guessing he's probably, if I had to guess, I would say he's probably looking to dump his stock and drive that price down and then rebuy and then dump it again, rebuy, just keep flipping it until,
so
because this is going to be a protracted battle. He doesn't like to lose.
Clearly.
See, with him, it's a matter of ego. He doesn't want to lose. Obviously, he believes in higher ideals like free speech. The thing with Agrawal, this Indian guy who is running Twitter,
yeah,
and people like him, they see this as death. They see this as an existential crisis, because Twitter is not an American company, even though it's based in the U.S. The people who run it, like you see, who's the guy? Jack Dorsey.
Jack Dorsey, the way previous CEO.
Yeah, you can tell it's like he's really into Eastern mythology. He's the way he dresses, the way he acts. He
cosplaying as Rasputin all the time.
Yeah, he obviously does not view the American tradition, the American culture, American Christianity, and our civilization as something to be emulated and honored. He wants to reach out to other civilizations and build that as the basis for his ego, for his identity. And it's very telling that they would get an Indian guy to run Twitter after he steps down.
Well, and shortly after he was hired, in an interview, like a conference call with other higher ups at Twitter and staff members there, he explicitly said that, you know, Twitter, our obligation is not to free speech. Our obligation is to, you know, protecting people from hate speech, and something along those lines.
Oh, you're talking about Agrawal?
Agrawal,
yeah, yeah. So he said, well, we don't really want to run it on based on the First Amendment. We want to run it based on, like you said, like on the public good, because they see themselves as trying to save the world from itself. They said they almost have a messianic complex that not just Americans, but people in general, especially white people, but especially Western people, are naturally violent, are naturally conquering colonizers, and it's their job to try to tamp down on that. So they're basically a leftist super PAC. That's basically what they run as. They're pretending to be a social media company when they're left to super PAC. But people like him, like Agrawal, they're going to screw their shareholders over as much as they possibly can, because they genuinely believe if somebody like Elon Musk takes over Twitter, he's going to invite Donald Trump back. He's going to invite neo-Nazis back and fascists back. These fascists then are going to run wild on Twitter. They're going to win the day, because, again, they believe the only way to save civilization is to shut people up and end free speech, because they believe that human beings – they believe correctly that human beings are flawed, but they believe that they are the saviors in yes. order to tamp down this, because they believe that if you allow people free speech, fascists will win the day because they have superior arguments than liberals. And then everyone will become fascist. Fascism will take over America. And then people who look like Agrawal are going to be rounded up and put on trains and sent to camps. Like, this is literally what they believe.
That's so what they believe.
You have to understand from their perspective, this is a nightmare. This is a nightmare scenario where you have a white South African billionaire who's going to come in and restore 2016 Twitter. So
God, that'd be so good.
In their minds, they saved the world from fascism by kicking Trump off and taking over these social media companies. And this is a nightmare scenario. Well,
and they're continuing to do it to this day, because, again, they primarily have gone after accounts that continue to point out the fact and cite proof that the 2020 election was stolen, or even before that with the Hunter Biden story. Remember the New York Post story? You physically, if you posted the URL to the New York Post Hunter Biden original reporting from October 2020, Twitter would not let you hit the tweet button. It would not let you post that URL. They blocked that story in order to win the election for Biden. And if you say anything about the election being stolen, you are instantly kicked off Twitter immediately. If you voice any support for the January 6th protesters and prisoners, you're instantly kicked off Twitter. Boom, you're gone. But back to what you said briefly about how I think we should close on this, how they believe they have the savior complex of they need to save the world from itself. This was repeated with regards to the Twitter battle, most perfectly by a very unlikely source. Those two walking, talking Botox advertisements over at MSNBC, Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. When you first told me about this, Jacob, I thought you were joking. I thought you were memeing about this. There is no way they actually said this. But this is a clip from their program, Morning Joe. And this is what – pay attention especially to what Mika had to say. They're saying the quiet part out loud. They're not even hiding it anymore.
Who were Trump voters and are still Trump supporters, they go, yeah, you guys are going crazy. He's doing – what are you so surprised about? He's doing exactly what he said he's going to do.
Well, and I think that the dangerous, you know, edges here are that he's trying to undermine the media, trying to make up his own facts – And it could be that while unemployment and the economy worsens, he could have undermined the messaging so much that he can actually control exactly what people think. And that is our job.
Yeah, if you look at the issues, Yamiche is right. He's doing exactly what he said.
It's our job. That is our job to control what people think. Again, I did not think that was real. I thought someone was like paraphrasing, but she actually said that on live television to their audience of about, what, 20,000 people who watch MSNBC, give or take. That's what we're up against. This is that savior complex, that God complex we were just talking about, of these people who think it is their job to protect us from ourselves and to say, oh no, you're not allowed to see information that could lead you questioning our narrative. You're not allowed to see information that could lead you to questioning the election and questioning the actions of the government. It's our job to tell you what you need to think about everything going on in America and in the world today.
Well, that's why trust in media has dropped. The people who strongly trust the media has dropped to 7% in the United States. Mm-hmm. Basically, MSNBC's audience. That's all that's left that strongly supports the media.
Yeah, and that's about 7% too high. So Godspeed, Mr. Musk. Hopefully, again, like you said, he is in this for the long term. He does not like to lose. We will see where this goes. If he wins, again, can you imagine the hype that if he wins, Trump is back on Twitter by the end of 2022? That will immediately be a game changer, certainly for the midterms, but also for, again, the big number everyone's thinking about, 2024.
Well, just one last thing is, in my opinion, the best case scenario would be for other like-minded billionaires and multimillionaires to buy into Twitter and ally with Elon Musk.
Yes.
Because this current provision, it lasts for a year. So for a year, they're allowed to dilute the shares if one shareholder reaches 15%. So Elon Musk can reach 14.9%. He can buy in that much. And then if a bunch of other small billionaires or small multimillionaires could each buy a percent, 2%, 5%, they could eventually build over a quarter of the company, maybe even more than 50% of the company. And then even with this provision, he could still take over the company. So hopefully other rich Republicans, I don't even know if Musk is a Republican. He might not even vote for all I know. But hopefully other rich people who believe in free speech and want to see Twitter return to its ancient glory will step in and join Team Musk.
God willing. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have left for this episode of The Right Take. Thank you guys so much, as always, for tuning in. Be sure to follow all of our latest content at our website, righttakepodcast.com. The full list of podcast platforms and social media sites where we are available, righttakepodcast.com/subscribe. And as always, if you guys are feeling ever so generous, righttakepodcast.com/support. We'll talk to you next week, guys.